And just some preliminary remarks while you're setting up, so it's not so quiet in here. I want to remind each of you, you have 15 minutes for presentation of your case. Appellant counsel, obviously, you've both been here before. You have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please remember to indicate your name and which party you're speaking on behalf of for our recording purposes. The microphone has been adjusted by the parties that were ahead of you, so feel free to set it up for your own personal comfort. And with that said, I'll ask our marshal to call the next case for
Now hearing case number A230917, the Townhomes of Raspberry Ridge Homeowners Association versus Hiscox Insurance Company.
When you're ready, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm not as tall as the previous attorney here, so I have to make an adjustment. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Chris Goodman. I represent the appellant, Hiscox Insurance Company, in this appeal. We bring this appeal asking this court to reverse the district court's decision establishing liability for Hiscox for an appraisal award arising out of a June 2017 hailstorm. The issues for the panel's consideration include, number one, that the district court deviated from longstanding principles of contract interpretation in concluding as a matter of law that the notice of this loss, which came 10 months after the damage was discovered, was prompt. Number two, the district court's decision is contrary to a decision this court issued just in October of last year, interpreting my client's insurance policy, Colby Lake Fourth Association versus Hiscox. That's specific to the replacement cost coverage section of the policy. Number three, the district court misinterpreted the appraisal award that established the amount of the loss, in that the panel identified two prior payments the insured received for prior hail claims as a coverage issues being for the courts to determine. But the district court decided as a matter of law that that wasn't a coverage issue and adopted the appraisal award as the damages in the case. And finally, we've raised the anti-fraud provision in the policy, which is consistent with Minnesota Statute 68.08, in that the insured, the respondent, was asked about the condition of the property prior to my client renewing the policy, and the information we received was, frankly, not correct. The first thing, the threshold issue in the case is
Counsel, where did you ask for that?
What's that, Your Honor?
When did you ask for that, and how did you ask for it? You did initially when you...
Ask for which part, Your Honor?
The condition of the property. I mean, you had a chance when you initially sold this policy to do an inspection. That inspection was done. You asked them what was going on. They told you. And then when they renewed, you didn't ask them anything else, did you?
I disagree with that, Your Honor. I mistakenly thought you were referring to something that we established with the court record. You're talking about the investigation before the first policy is issued in 2015. Pacific Inspections inspects the property. They don't detect any hail damage. That's the argument that the respondent raised.
Right.
I believe it's the Nathan insurance case that the plaintiff cites talks about how that investigation prevents the insurance company from using untrue statements in the application from voiding coverage. We've distinguished that case in our brief.
But I'm asking, what did you do at the time of the renewal that would have forced them to disclose that they had this ongoing issue with American Family?
Right. So what the company that was processing the renewal was V3 Insurance Partners. They sold this program, if you will, to Hiscox. And Carol Teasley, we have an affidavit from her that is undisputed in the record. This Community Association Program renewal application, that's the document that Ms. Teasley relies on to determine if additional information is necessary. And the last question of a 7-question yes or no form was, have there been any changes in the, among other things, building values or building maintenance? The district court said that because the form didn't ask about the word claims, which is the respondent's argument, that the right question wasn't asked. Our argument to this court and to the district court was whether there's a claim is downstream from whether there's damage.
The application didn't ask whether there was damage. The application specifically addressed building values, assessments, maintenance, personal property, or any other exposures, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So which of those terms would have triggered the obligation to make the disclosure that you're arguing should have been made?
V for value and M for maintenance, they're capitalized in there. And I think anticipating this question, I think a hypothetical might make sense of this. These days, cars are traded in online. You provide the VIN number, et cetera. Someone runs a vehicle history. And let's say I'm agreeing to trade in my car this afternoon at Maurer Chevrolet for $10,000. That's the blue book value of my car. But there was a storm last night. Let's say it's warmer weather and there's hail. I show up on the lot and I've got dents all over my car from hail. The person selling me the new car is not going to give me $10,000 for that car. It's got hail dents all over it. They have to remedy those hail dents before they can try and sell it to someone else. And so the value of that car has gone down and the maintenance needs have gone up because the car is no longer worth $10,000. The point I'm making, Your Honors, is when we ask about value or maintenance, that's broader than did you act on the information you have about the condition of your property to make a claim to American Family or some other insurer?
How do they know all that? How do they know what you're thinking?
They don't need to be prescient, Your Honor, or clairvoyant to figure that out, whatever the right word is. The person who filled
Seriously?
Out the person who
based on the words you're talking about?
The person who filled out the form was Pat Beelan. She's the property manager for this company. She testified at her deposition in this case that she fills out this same form for other insurers that were part of the same program. And the question was simply, has there been a change in the value or maintenance need of the property? If the property has sustained what they put in a proof of loss to American Family was $2 million worth of hail damage, then clearly the value has gone down because the maintenance needs have gone up. That's why they told American Family we need more money.
Was the association working with an insurance agent at the time they submitted the renewal application? I mean,
go ahead.
And I'm raising that point because, you know, it would seem to me that the association would have been entitled to rely on, you know, any representations made by its insurance agent in filling out the application. So you've got two people filling out this application that, you know, doesn't clearly ask for, I don't think, the information that you're suggesting it does. I just don't understand how, given those circumstances, the district court erred in finding there was no misrepresentation as a matter of law.
They were working with an agent, but the person who filled out the form was specifically asked to verify that the information on the form was accurate. And just 3 days before Ms. Beelan signed the form electronically verifying it was accurate, she received an email from American Family informing her of a $200,000 payment for that prior claim. So she knows not only that there was damage, but the claim has been reported earlier that year, 2016, and that money is forthcoming. And so this focus on, well, you didn't ask about claims. Claims is something that's important, but what matters is whether the value of the property has changed. Has something happened to it? Has a building burnt down? Has hail impacted the property? Whether a claim has come out of that is a different story. And all this form would do is then trigger a need to ask additional information from the insured. And so when the answer is no, it's the same condition as when you issued the first policy year. Ms. Teasley recommends to my client that we renew, and we do. Unbeknownst to us, there's this ongoing American Family claim, which is something we certainly would have wanted to investigate. Again, the case law we have, I believe it's a Howard case, the issue for materiality and the misrepresentation is whether if it's information that if the insurance company had possessed it, it would have caused it to reach a different conclusion in terms of coverage, changing the terms of the policy, not issuing it. Undisputed testimony from Carol Teasley in her affidavit, yeah, I wouldn't have recommended Hiscox even renew the policy if we knew about this other claim. I'd like to get to some other issues to discuss. Prompt notice is...
I'm trying to...
Yes, Your Honor.
I get what you're getting at. So I don't want to leave this because I need to follow through in this. Okay, so at the time you're insuring them, the American Family stuff is pending. So you check out the property, you know what it's worth, the value, all of that stuff.
Little twist. When we inspected the property in 2015, the respondent had not reported a claim to American Family. There was no ongoing investigation.
Right, but it was whatever the damage was there.
2015 storm, yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry, go ahead.
But do it the other way, because then when you ask if there's any change or whatever, well, if they got the money, didn't they fix the windows? Wouldn't it have went up in value versus down? I mean, isn't that... I mean, you're talking about the negative, that it's worth less, but perhaps what you're getting at is that they just pocketed some money and didn't do anything to improve it.
Well, if it's an actual cash value payment, which they didn't have, they had that $200,000 at the time of renewal, they have the right to use or not use the money.
Right.
Okay, right. But the issue isn't where that may take us. The issue under the case law is it information that would have caused the insurer to either not issue the policy or change the terms or conditions of it to account for that prior loss? We're deprived of the opportunity to make that consideration because Ms. Beelen, when she says, yeah, the property is the same condition you insured it in, she knows that's not true. She's reported a claim. She's received a payment on a claim. She has that information. It's not someone else at the HOA that has that. It's Ms. Beelen.
Okay, I get that. So, I was just wondering what happened if there had been some improvement. And I know you want to get towards the thrust of your argument in terms of the prompt notice.
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. Prompt notice is a very straightforward issue. The appellate courts of the state have gone to great pains to assist insurance companies in writing policies, district court judges in interpreting them. It's just like contract interpretation.
It's not defined in your policy.
Okay, and those are we have in Northfield, and we have two cases cited from this court in our brief that say just because a term isn't defined in a policy doesn't automatically make it ambiguous. Rather, the contract interpretation principles say that courts are supposed to look to the plain and ordinary meaning of the word. In briefing this issue to the district court, we cited to dictionary definitions that generally speaking say without delay or immediate.
If you meant immediate, though, why wouldn't the policy say immediate?
Again.
Or within 30 days.
The fact that that term is not defined in terms of days or a different word than prompt doesn't make it ambiguous. That is respectfully rewriting the policy to say, well, you could have said something that would have been, in the eyes of whichever judge is reading it, better or easier to understand.
Well, you did in terms of when you bring suit. You get 2 years. You put a time frame in your policy on when the suit can be, the parameters.
Yes, Your Honor. That's the Henning case that both parties cited. That case says that the one-year time to sue is per se unreasonable. Okay, my client's policy says 2 years time to sue. But they make clear in that decision that the time to sue is not the same as the time to give notice. And in fact, most of the cases cited by both parties that talk about notice provisions in policies in this state tend to say as soon as practicable. It just so happens that my policy uses the word prompt, which we don't have a body of case law on, otherwise this discussion would be easier.
It's not like it was going to go away. As compared to some cases, you know, where you have a prompt requirement because you want to make sure it doesn't perish or disappear or anything like that. I mean, this is something that's is likely to remain.
If I understand Your Honor's question, the Sterling State Bank case and then more in 1969 and then more recently the Cargill v. Evanston case talk about that. And what they talk about is the reason why we have notice provisions and they are enforceable in this state is because it gives the insurance company a chance to promptly investigate and assess the damage and just prevent fraudulent claims. That applies with even greater force here because, and we've cited this in our brief, in November of 2017, so the same year that the damage is discovered, the board minutes show a unit owner said, hey, I know we've got the American Family claim, but what about the damage from the June 2017 storm? And the board says, we told the unit owner we're aware of the new damage, but we'll resolve that when the current claim is settled with American Family.
What is your stronger argument here? Is it that the district court erred as a matter of law, and as a matter of law, 10 months is never prompt? Or is it that you are entitled to a trial on the factual question of whether the notice given here was prompt?
I don't mean to dodge the question, but I would say both. We say we win as a matter of law because the facts relevant to the notice issue are undisputed. There is no dispute. It's a finding of fact in the district court's decision that the association asked contractors to inspect the day after the storm, and the following board meeting a month later, two contractors report to the board, we don't think the roof has been damaged, but the windows have sustained new damage. And then my client, well, I, confirmed that in depositions of the board president and Pat Beelen, the property manager, that yes, what's in the board meetings is accurate. So to answer Hunter's question, with the undisputed facts, we just need to plug in what prompt means. And we disregard dictionary definitions in the district court's decision. We conflate the time for notice with the time to sue. And we don't give, we essentially nullify the word prompt by essentially saying that, well, as long as the claim is reported within 2 years, that's okay.
Is that what the district court said, though, really?
It pointed to the time to sue provision. We address all this in our brief. It pointed to the time to sue provision, which the Henning says is an improper conflation of principles. And again, the case law says we have to give meaning to all the words in the policy. So this decision begs for, what does prompt mean? We're not saying that prompt means 10 months or less. It has to be dependent on the facts of the case. But in this case, the facts are undisputed. There was a 10-month delay in reporting the claim, and what happened that finally caused them to report it? American Family said, you didn't sue within 2 years, so you can't get any more money from us. And then the board minutes say, on the advice of counsel, then and only then did they decide to report the claim to my client. My time is up. That is not prompt. That is a conscious decision not to be prompt. And so we'd ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Adina Bergstrom. I represent the respondent, the Townhomes of Raspberry Ridge Association, in this matter. We are asking this court respectfully to affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment to my client, which found coverage for the nearly $4 million appraisal award that was issued after nearly 4 years of this claim being handled by the insurance company. As a preliminary matter, there are really only two valid issues here on this appeal. As a matter of law, the challenge to the appraisal award being brought on appeal was never brought before the district court and is improperly before this court now. There was also no argument that there should be an offset for the Signature Select, the contractor's payment on the 2015 claim to the association that, again, Hiscox is trying to bring before this court that was not on summary judgment. And I would further submit that there is no challenge in the principal brief brought by Hiscox on the coverage interpretation on the 200-day language in the policy regarding replacement cost coverage, and therefore their introduction of such an argument in their reply brief based on the Colby Lakes decision is inappropriate and should be struck. My client was not afforded any opportunity to brief the issue of the coverage interpretation, which would be different had they brought it in their principal brief, and we would have done so. We've been deprived of any opportunity to address that issue, and I would submit that any issue on Colby Lakes would be inappropriate to consider. In terms of the grant of summary judgment by Judge Ireland, it is on all fours with number one, the record, and number two, firmly rooted principles of Minnesota law. Starting first with the challenge to the appraisal award. Now again, below, no challenge to the appraisal award at all. And the judge properly noted that in his order at the very onset. It can't be challenged now on appeal. We have a clear award awarding for this June 11, 2017 storm. The appraisal panel was fully aware of all of the prior damages, including the 2015 claim. That was not information ever hidden from the insurance company, and the numerous reports in the record by Hiscox's own selected adjuster bear that out. The appraisal panel was fully aware of those prior damages and divided out the 2017 damage in issuing its award. So the judge correctly interfaced that with the hail damage coverage under the policy, which is an all perils policy, and provided coverage and issued such an order in line with the damages. Now, in terms of the defenses that Hiscox has raised, I think it's incredibly important to note two things. One, these were litigation defenses. This claim was handled for the better part of 2 years before it wound up before the district court, not because of coverage issues, mind you, but because Hiscox refused and continued to cancel the appraisal process. So initially it ended up in Ramsey County District Court because Hiscox would not follow through with the appraisal process. But at that point in time, and this is late 2019 when it's filed, and 2020 before we get an answer, there was never any sort of coverage issue raised with late notice or with any sort of allegations with fraud, including the only fraud issue brought up to this court in the application. Obviously, all that information was at the disposal of Hiscox for years. Now, why is this particularly relevant here? Because we all know on summary judgment, one of the questions is, could reasonable minds differ? And on this record, the answer is clearly no, and Judge Ireland ruled correctly. The reason why we know that reasonable minds could not differ is because for more than 2 years, the minds of the insurance company and of Raspberry Ridge did not differ. We don't have a situation, let's start with notice. We've got a prompt notice provision. It's no secret that at all times Hiscox knew when the claim was turned in.
Well, why would prompt not go to a jury?
Because in this particular situation, no one raised prompt. You're looking at the reasonable minds here, right? Is there a difference in reasonable minds? If there had been a difference in a reasonable minds, and this is where maybe some of the other cases come into play, including Sterling, if reasonable minds differed, then the insurance company would be the one to say first, this is not prompt, we're not going to afford you coverage. We have literally four layers of insurance oversight. We have the vice president of claims, Jeremy Catlin, who's also a lawyer. We have a very experienced field adjuster, Tony Damaris. We have a claims administrator, Julie Corley. And then as of early 2019, we have outside counsel of Tony Krall, all involved with this claim, and none raised notice or prompt notice as being an issue. You know, we have this issue under the law with...
Let me just be clear on what you're asking us to do. You're asking us to conclude based on those circumstances that the district court didn't err as a matter of law. Is that why you're bringing those circumstances to our attention?
It is why I'm bringing it to your attention. I am asking this court to conclude that under the record in this case and the facts of this case, the court reviewed the record and based on the evidence in the record properly concluded that under these factual circumstances that the notice was prompt. Again, this for the reasons that have already been articulated, including by your honors, the damages did not change. There was no issue with notice raised until the case was in litigation and for some time thereafter. So we have a situation where the insurance company has handled the claim for the better part of 2 years, has made two...
Sounds like you're addressing prejudice, though, to me. And the argument that the insurance company is making is that this was prompt notice was a condition precedent to coverage. And I think that's a pretty persuasive argument that you are not conceding in your brief.
You know, and I think that, and I appreciate that commentary. I'm really actually getting to the point of not necessarily prejudice, but I will address that for your honor as well. Under Minnesota law, and I'm specifically looking at the Reliance Motor Company case versus St. Paul Fire, that case holds, and again, it's dealing with notice, when an adjuster investigates and offers to settle, they've ostensibly waived the notice argument. Now, again, this falls back on foundational principles of insurance law. The insurance company knows the policy better than the policyholders. They need to raise their defenses as soon as they're reasonably, available to raise. Again, they always knew when the claim was turned in, so they could have raised it on day 2, day 10, day 25. They didn't. And here, when we're looking at Reliance Motor, honestly, we have two different things going on. We've got an investigation over the course of 2 years, including multiple experts. We have the initial settlement offer by the insurance company in November of 2018 that led to the first payment of about $250,000 in January of 2019. More investigation happening throughout the summer of 2019. And then we have another offer from the insurance company of $2.9 million from their own experts estimate. So under Reliance Motor, we have this concept of it's been ostensibly waived at that point in time, and it would be not necessarily prejudicial in terms of the investigation, but prejudicial to my client at that point in time for them to reverse their coverage decision. The Henning case talks about things being unreasonably short, and I know counsel addressed the Henning case, which does deal with the time to sue, but it cannot be overlooked that Hiscox is attempting to use this notice provision and 10 months as a means to deprive my client of coverage, to strip away the coverage. That has the same force and effect of the two-year or a one-year time frame in a policy for them to recover benefits. So I do think it is relevant to the consideration from that perspective, because Minnesota law, especially insurance law, is loath to strip the insured of coverage that it has, in fact, paid for under the policy. In terms of the fraud, Judge Ireland also ruled correctly, again, based on this record. In terms of the questions that were on the renewal application, I think that obviously the order and the application speaks for itself. Judge Ireland actually copied and pasted the questions into page 4 of his order. I heard repeated reference just now in argument that my client was asked about the condition of the property. Not so. The question speaks for itself. Building values, assessments, maintenance, and personal property and other exposures. My client and the testimony of property manager Pat Bieland made clear that she believed she answered this correctly because there were no changes to those items. And we need to compare and contrast to the year prior in 2015 when that insurance policy was issued. They asked the same questions, had the association through property management provide the square footage of the buildings, the age of the buildings, things that went to value, and then in addition to those questions, ask separately for a loss run. A loss run is a claims history. How many losses or claims have you had at this property? They did not ask for a new claims history or loss run in 2016. So that, looking at the record as a whole, Judge Ireland correctly discerned that those two requests were completely disparate and different. They didn't ask for information in 2016, and the law fully supports the conclusion that an insurance company can't not ask for information and then years later come back to the insured and say, we're going to deny you for fraud because you didn't give us information that we never asked for. In terms of cases that support that contention, I mean, certainly the record speaks for itself. But in addition, cases such as, we talk about Nathan versus St. Paul, but the Transamerican case touches on that, the Craigmile versus Sorensen case where there wasn't a written application and the court said, well, there's no misrepresentation in writing if you don't have a written application. Here, it's akin to what we have going on here. They didn't ask the question. If they had asked the question and we had said, no, there are no other claims, that would be a different scenario, but not the record that we have underlying Judge Ireland's decision. It's very simple. If they wanted to know, they should have asked. I think that goes to materiality as well. If something is incredibly material to an insurance company's decision to insure, they need to ask for that information. Otherwise, it would seem clear that it's not important. In terms of this concept of increased risk of loss, there is no increased risk of loss. And I believe that's where we get into some of the nuances of insurance law. When there's prior damage to a property and then new damage happens to that property again. So you have new damage on top of old damage. What gets affected is you have a lower actual cash value because more depreciation is applied. The amount that it would cost to replace that property doesn't change because that's your cost to replace it. So here, because we had 2015 damage and then 2017 damage overlaid on it, plus new damage, which Hiscox knew, they spent more than 4 years investigating, because they knew about those damages, there was actually a lower actual cash value. So there's less risk, not more risk. And again, replacement cost doesn't change. That is the same. If you need to replace a window, it doesn't matter whether it has 7 hits of hail and you need to replace it, or if it has 25 hits of hail and you need to replace it, you're still covering the replacement cost of that window. So we don't have an increased risk of loss. I would like to touch briefly also on the Colby Lake situation. First of all, because it is before this court on a reply brief, I would ask this court to not consider any implications of that particular case on this appeal, because the coverage and the interpretation of the 200-day language in terms of replacement cost coverage under the policy is not in the principal brief. I would also just bring to the court's attention, as you well know, it's an unpublished opinion that was based primarily on the facts of that particular situation in Colby Lakes, which are markedly different in this case. Most specifically, in Colby Lake, it was a default judgment. There was no developed record. We had a situation where the insurance company actually paid more than the actual cash value that was awarded to the association. None of those facts are like this particular case. And I think that it's, again, very important to look at how did Hiscox handle this case? How did Judge Ireland apply the language of the policy in the context of this case? Because like all contracts, you don't apply the language in a vacuum. You apply it according to the party's intentions, and you apply it in the context according to the circumstances of the case. Here we have admissions from, again, Vice President Jeremy Catlin, who was the one making the coverage decisions, that he did not identify any coverage issues with the policy. No defenses, no fraud, no 200-day language. So that is very clear in the record. I know that there was some indication in the reply brief that I didn't cite to the correct page. That is my fault. I believe it should have been a page 33, and it was a page 30 that I cited. So my apologies for any confusion. But those admissions are clearly in the record. In conclusion, Judge Ireland's summary judgment order, based on the record before it and based on Hiscox's failure to produce evidence to substantiate every aspect of its defenses and its claim, was properly entered in this case, and I would ask this court to affirm in favor of the association. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bergstrom. Mr. Goodman, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just going straight to the Colby Lake decision, that was a decision involving the identical policy. The interpretation of the policy was a question of law. The decision came out.
I agree that you only raised that issue in your reply brief.
I can't say that it's in my opening brief. It was in our statement of the case. And we cite in our reply brief case law from this court that says that when decisions are rendered, they're supposed to be based on the law that exists at the time the decision was rendered. Was there a motion to strike that argument in our reply? No. Could something have been filed, a surreply, if you will, some kind of additional briefing by the respondent? Of course, I would have had no basis to object to that. But we had a development in the law that occurred during the pendency of this appeal where three other judges from this court looked at the identical policy and interpreted it contrary to the way Judge Ireland did and adopted identically to what we've argued in this case, that you have to commence the repair within 200 days of the loss to preserve your right to make a replacement cost coverage claim. That didn't happen here. And that's also undisputed. So we have undisputed facts. We have a decision of this court interpreting the identical policy language. We're simply asking the court to incorporate that in this decision, which would mean my client is not responsible for the replacement cost portion of the appraisal award. That's the relief we're requesting based on the Colby Lake decision. Colby Lake also addresses the waiver arguments that came up just now from respondent. And I didn't spend a lot of time on that because that was the district court's fallback position, kind of hedging. If this court reverses, Judge Ireland was saying, well, then we're going to have a trial on waiver and estoppel. We've addressed that in our brief to say that waiver and estoppel don't expand coverage. But that's not a basis for why the district court rendered its ruling. So that shouldn't be bootstrapped as it was just a moment ago to try and justify the district court's conclusions that led to the judgment. But with respect to waiver and estoppel, one of the arguments we got, we heard just
well,
a moment.
Can I just ask you, are the issues of waiver and estoppel as presented here jury issues, or are those legal issues that a court could decide as a matter of law? I'll admit I'm a little confused by that portion of Judge Ireland's order.
What we argued, two-part answer. What we argued to the district court And there was actually supplemental briefing after the summary judgment motions were fully briefed, at requested by the district court, on how do we apply waiver or estoppel. The legal argument we made, to answer Your Honor's question, is that under a number of cases cited in our briefing, waiver and estoppel cannot be used to expand coverage. If we do not provide coverage when repairs are commenced more than 200 days after the loss, you can't use waiver or estoppel to circumvent that. If prompt notice of a loss is a condition precedent to coverage, you can't circumvent that by saying, well, you stood on this coverage provision but not that one in a letter. Or the insurance agent investigating the case said this, and that made us think there was coverage. You can't have a gotcha argument like that to avoid coverage. So legally, our argument to the district court was, we win, no waiver or estoppel. Pragmatically, the second part to answering Your Honor's question, if any time the insured makes the arguments we just heard today, that was sufficient to raise a jury question on waiver or estoppel, we would never be able to resolve coverage issues on cross motions for summary judgment, which a litany of cases say is the normal and recognized way to resolve coverage disputes. We would have, in any case where one side thought the facts weren't good for it, either the insurer or the insured could bring up waiver or estoppel based on whatever representation you can find. And if that's the decision of this court affirming Judge Ireland, that would allow that party to avoid summary judgment, say, hey, Your Honor, District Court, we have to have a trial on those waiver or estoppel issues. That would upend the way cases like this are handled and have been handled for decades. You don't get to avoid coverage being decided as a matter of law and convert it to a fact question simply by saying waiver or estoppel are arguments for or against coverage. There was an argument about forfeitures and how it, I think it was a Nath Brothers case. The case law in this state says that a forfeiture of coverage for failure to satisfy a condition is appropriate and enforceable so long as there's specific language indicating that's a condition precedent. That's how the insurance companies are told by the courts to communicate to the insured to allow the failure to satisfy a condition to result in a forfeiture. We have that in our policy. There's also an argument about the time it took to assert these positions. 60418 is our bad faith statute. We can't deny coverage when we don't have a reasonable basis to do that. We didn't have the board minutes that I've been referring to throughout this argument today until October 2020, and that was more than two years after the claim is reported. So, of course, we couldn't stand on late notice. But we do have, last thing I'll say, Exhibits 61 and 64. We have several reservation of rights paragraphs and letters we sent the insured as the claim was being investigated. So we preserved our right to bring up those issues if and when the facts warranted them. So we would ask the court to reverse and at a minimum to remand for clarification of the appraisal award and reversal of the replacement cost coverage decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The matters are deemed submitted and a decision will be issued in the 90 days. Thank you for appearing today.